On this day in 1983, Prince played Purple Rain for the first time. Before the 1984 blockbuster Purple Rain catapulted Prince onto the national stage, international stage, there was an August the 3rd, 1983 benefit concert for the Minnesota Dance Theatre at the recently rebranded First Avenue. And it was there that the budding pop star debuted much of the Purple Rain album tracks and recorded the versions of Purple Rain, I Would Die For You and Baby I'm a Star, as heard in the soundtrack and film. Now, when the time came to perform the now famous track, the crowd seemed to be stunned silent. Producer Dave Rivkin said nobody clapped because they had never heard the songs before. It was incredible. I mean, little did I know it was going to be that big of a recording, he said. Prince was not a well-known figure back then, and this was the kind of recording that launched him into superstardom. So imagine Ellie being in that audience, hearing this for the first time, going, is that a good song? I don't really know.
It's an awesome song. That is one of the best albums of all time, and he's one of my most favourite
artists. Oh, you're a big
fan? Absolutely. Saw him in Auckland when he did his piano tour.
What do you think?
Literally weeks before he died.
Oh, you're lucky.
We were very lucky. A girlfriend and I went, this is going to cost a lot to get there for the seats and the flights and everything, but God, I'm so glad we did.
You don't regret it?
Oh, absolutely not. It was the experience she and I shared together was phenomenal without the fact that it was the, you know, he was gone within a few weeks after that, really. Yeah. But an incredible musician, writer, performer. One of my favourite artists.
What an experience being, because it was actually just a large theatre, wasn't it? And there he was, just actually very close by.
Yeah, he was. And he was wearing sneakers that had lights on them. So when he walked, the shoes lit up. And I'd never seen him perform like that before with just a piano and a mic. There was, I think, some sampling and other electronic sounds, but it was stunning. One of the best performances I've ever seen.
You a fan, Ellen?
A little bit. I think he's got a song called Money Don't Matter, which I think is just absolutely fabulous.
That's a great song, off Diamonds and Pearls.
Yeah. Very, very good song. I mean, how do people feel about all this release of his stuff from the vaults and everything? I sort of, like, there's an album that just came out this week, and, you know, I don't know. I think if he really wanted it released, he would have released it during his lifetime, just sort of scraping the barrel sort
of
thing.
But he was so prolific, though, wasn't he? That was the thing. And because he hasn't been around for a while now, there's been that gap, I guess, of him not releasing, so it's there to release. But, yeah, it is a bit weird, isn't it?
Some advice for those who get no attention at a car yard. We're talking about car yard sexism this afternoon. No service in a car yard. Go into the car and pop the hood. Gets the blokes paying attention just fine.
Well, you could slide across the hood.
Says a 50-year-old, says quoting 50-year-old woman who can do a pretty good petrol head impression if necessary. Kia ora panel, I'm listening to the panel on a 10x7 Sony battery radio. It works great. Thank you for that. All right, to this. Now, mortgage lending rules are to be toughened after the government has given the Reserve Bank approval to tighten loan-to-value ratios and move to bring in debt-to-income ratios. In a statement, Finance Minister Grant Robinson said the central bank would start consulting reducing low-deposit lending by banks to no more than 10% of the total lending from the current 20% starting October 1. But these debt-to-income ratios, he said, would be designed to minimise any negative effect on first home buyers, with consultation, as I said, starting later in the year. So to discuss is Infometrics senior economist Brad Olson. Brad, kia ora.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, first, what will this mean for people who want to buy a house, Brad?
Well, what it's going to mean overall is two things. One, there's some specifics around just how much money you might be able to get from the bank. The Reserve Bank now expected to consult on lowering the amount of cash that you can get with a low deposit. So you're going to have to stump up a bit more in general, but also signals that direction of travel, the Reserve Bank making it clear that they want to see lower levels of risky lending. They haven't seen that coming through quite as fast, and so they're looking at different ways to do that. The likes of DTIs a little bit further away, but possibly making other decisions around test rates and similar. All of these ideas designed to limit just how much risky high-value lending comes into the market.
linking lending to your income level, is that a fair thing to do? Doesn't it over-penalise those on a tighter income?
Well, that's sort of the point. And I say that because from the Reserve Bank's point of view, what they're wanting to do there is to make sure that if you have a loan, that you are actually able to service it, not only now, but in the future. And so the idea being that if you get a loan that is wildly outside what you earn, you know, there's a limit at which point, look, if your income changes, even by a little bit, that could make your ability to repay your loan quite difficult. So the thinking being that you want to limit just how many people have loan values that are or debts that are so much larger than their incomes means that there's generally speaking going to be less risk across the economy. And it's a similar sort of idea, not exactly the same, but similar with LVRs, by sort of saying, look, you know, from a bank, the bank's point of view, from the Reserve Bank's point of view, they want people to have more skin in the game themselves. So having to put up more of a deposit, not being able to put quite as much back on the retail banks.
All right, Alan, you first.
But surely the banks aren't lending to these sort of people who can't afford to repay them. I mean, that's the whole point. Surely the banks are doing their due diligence when they come to giving mortgages to people. So why would they even be lending, you know, these sort of amounts of money to people who potentially can't pay it back?
Well, I mean, we would have said that probably before 2008 as well, and we all see where that went. And look, I say that because one of the challenges is, at the moment, if you are a retail bank, you're making a lot of cash from mortgages. And so you're, you know, and without any sort of limitations, the risk that you have things that work fine in the current conditions but might not work fine when conditions turn is very much the risk the Reserve Bank's trying to look for. The other interesting change, though, that they're looking at is putting in what they're calling an interest rate floor, which would be for the test rates that the banks use. So at the moment, you can get a one-year fixed rate for a mortgage of about 2.55%. But the banks are using a test rate of anywhere between, I think, sort of, you know, around about 6.5% for basically if interest rates went up to 6.5%, could you still afford your mortgage? And that's, like you say, Alan, where they're trying to figure out if people can still make those payments by putting a test rate in with a certain floor. The Reserve Bank, the government can make a stronger case for, look, how many people are actually going to be able to make these repayments as we do start to see interest rates rise, because that will change the budgetary constraints for a household.
All right, Ali Jones.
But aren't first home buyers generally low earners? I know that's a broad statement. So is there's no way to avoid this harming first home buyers, surely?
Well, and that's the sort of the catch-22 that you have at the moment. You're absolutely right that first-home buyers are generally those who are going to be on lower incomes. What it also means, though, is that if the bank, Reserve Bank, does try to limit how much of this sort of policy hits first-home buyers, it also means that they're trying to, focus on different exposures. What I'm saying is, if you exempt first-home buyers, do you say that, look, first-home buyers are therefore more exposed if the housing market does go in a bad place, it does go, you know, to hell, and those first-home guys are going to be more exposed? It's a real catch-22.
Right. Hey, Noel, Brad, other changes to call the housing market have largely been, or what many see as ineffective so far at least. You know, you've got still an annual 20% growth in house prices. Will this help?
No. In short regard, I say that because
it's a straight answer.
So far, it's been really difficult to see how much of an impact they've had just so quickly. And I think importantly, they're also not being designed to cool the housing market. So that's not what their end goal is. It's to make sure the housing market doesn't fall down around our ears, in a sense. Now,
I see.
The challenge that the government, the Reserve Bank, is going to have is that with interest rates still so low, and still with 40 years or so worth of a backup of needing to build more, we're still a fair way away from seeing big, big changes. We might have slower house price growth coming forward, but we're still not seeing affordable housing for New Zealanders for decades to come.
Good. Wow. All right. Good to have you on the program, Brad. Informatics Senior Economist Brad Olson there. So that's quite a significant statement there, isn't it? Brief thoughts on that, Ellie Jones?
Yeah, I was one thing I was going to mention at the outset with the I've been thinking, but I changed it at the last minute, is there's a very interesting article in North and South in the August edition that looks at some of the issues with the costs of building and basically the frame, and I've said this before, the cost of framing and linings, which is two of the major parts of building a new house, for example. There's a monopoly in this market in New Zealand, and I'm very pleased to see that there's going to be, I think, the Consumer Affairs or who's doing the investigation into it. I didn't bring the article with me, but there is going to be an investigation into this. Of course, Fletcher's, who they're saying is who holds the monopoly in the building market at the moment, completely dismisses this. But I've heard from others as well. It's very difficult for new items, new building products to come into the market because they essentially get shifted out.
Mm. Now, just on the Peter Burling and Blair Tuke, they are on the water chasing another medal. And at this stage, if you haven't caught up yet, Great Britain is leading. So not looking like a gold so far, but you never know with that duo, Burling and Tuke. It is 4:45. You're on the panel, RNZ National, this afternoon. I am with Professor Ellen Blackman and Ellie Jones. Ellen here is in Tamaki Makaurau, and Ellie is in Ōtautahi there.
Is the weather awful where you two are? It's horrendous down here at the moment. It's like 8 degrees and it's been heavily raining all day.
Well, I had no sleep. Because the house was battered by extraordinarily strong winds. This is where I am, Blockhouse Bay. It was really quite something. So, you know, quite a few lines down, that type of thing. So running on empty, but lots of fun with all these texts coming through. I tell you what, you're all... you're all telling me what you're listening to the panel on. The latest is I'm listening on a JVC 970 stereo system, tapes record radio. Cost us $1,000 plus to fix up. Well worth it. It belonged to my dad, says Angela. Now, to this very interesting article from the Hawke's Bay today, caught our attention here. Our ageism shame. Hastings man with a folder of qualifications can't find work. And it profiles a Hastings man, 74-year-old Ernest Seedham, who retrained in computer systems after an injury ended his building career, which is great. But after getting a bachelor's degree in computing systems from EIT in 2004 and a folder of various other course certificates since, he hasn't had a full-time permanent job in 20 years and has applied for hundreds of jobs to no avail. Is this ageism at play? Jeff Pearman is the founder of Partners in Charge, a consultancy specialising in the area of age and work. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Yeah, great to be with you, Wallace, and to be talking about something I think which is critically important.
Well, pleasure to have you on, Jeff. First, yeah. I've got to say, well done, Ernest, successfully getting this degree in computing off the back of another career.
Well, I know. I think that's what we're seeing more and more. Wallace, there's people in their 50s, and he's been in the building industry, retraining. And I often say to people, you know, 50, you could be in the workforce for another 20, 25 years. How do you want that part of your career to look? And do something at that stage before you get later in life when maybe, you know, you're 60 and needing to retrain then. So I think all credit to him taking the initiative at a point when he had an injury.
He clearly wants to work. Hundreds of applications sent out, no bite. Do you see this sort of thing? How common is this, do you think, Jeff?
Well, look, I think it's a global phenomenon, Wallace, that we see ageism. And we need to be very, very careful about talking about this, because if we start to look at age discrimination, there's typically two groups who are impacted, and that's older workers and younger workers. And both are impacted for similar sorts of reasons. In actual fact, that's the perceptions of their ability to contribute. So I think there is present. Where I'm cautious, mm-hmm. and I'm cautious in saying this, is that it's also easy when we are rejected. And you know, I was looking for jobs in my late 50s. When we get a rejection letter, or we actually even don't hear, to blame ageism. Mm. when in actual fact
right.
that might not be the case. It can become a convenient whipping boy in this discussion, but also I'm not shying away from the fact of saying it is real and it is present and unconscious bias and discrimination operate.
Ellie.
Yeah, no, well said, Jeff. I think you hit the nail on the head there. I think that, as you said, Ernest is to be praised for retraining. A BA in computing systems might not have been the best degree to get, considering how quickly technology changes. It was in 2004, that's 17 years ago. I mean, there may be other reasons here, so I'm really glad that you said that. But I do think, too, that we don't value our older people full stop, you know, unlike some other cultures around the world where they really are considered wise and that they're human. Hugely respected and valued. I don't think we do here. I think it's a deeply embedded problem that goes beyond ageism and jobs. I think we need to value our older people more anyway.
What I would say, Ali, is that when we look at the numbers across the OECD, New Zealand has one of the highest participation rates of people over the age of 50-55 in the workforce. And we have one of the higher participation rates of people over 65. So often this discussion doesn't focus on those who actually are still in work and going to work every day and wanting to work in workplaces that are much more age inclusive. So typically we end up on focusing on the people that can't get work. And I think we've got to do a lot more work in that area. But that's only a small segment of those over 60 who are still in the workforce and going to work every day.
Alan?
Yeah, I guess, you know, when it comes to applying for jobs, when you're in that position, I mean, things like not putting your age on your CV, I suppose, things like that. But then again, it's probably going to be a dead giveaway because you're going to have a CV that's, you know, got some dates on it anyway. I was employed from, you know, this time to this time. And it's going to be difficult to maybe hide the fact that you are someone of that age looking for work. But
what's the mess? Oh, Jeff, sorry.
That is the case, and like I went through that in my late 50s, and I think your self-esteem takes a huge hit when you think that you're going to be in a career for the rest of your working life, and the temptation is to want to tell a potential employer how good you are and everything you've done and every qualification you've had since you left school. And that's why I say shy away from a chronological CV and do a functional CV. But I think the other thing that we forget is that actually a vast percentage of jobs are not filled applying to an ad on Seek or in the newspaper. They're actually filled through the informal job market. And that's where people need, I think, to be much more active is in that informal job market.
Really good tip there, actually. Shy away from a chronological CV and go towards a functional CV. That's a really good first step, actually. Yeah. So you don't have that sort of 10-page list of qualifications. Nice one, Jeff. Yeah. Hey, we'll leave it there, but kia ora, Jeff. Thank you for that. That's Jeff Pearman, the founder of Partners in Charge. Text here, I'm 63, having been a carpenter for then 25 years, secondary teacher, and back to carpenter the past 10 years. I'm currently a full-time student. Will qualify as a quantity surveyor at the age of 65, fingers crossed. That's the spirit, isn't it, Ali?
It is. I'm exhausted just listening to that. How on earth could you retrain that many times? Good on you.
All right. Now, to this, interesting, the advocacy group Blind Low Vision has criticised the colourful artwork installed on two Takapuna streets as part of a road improvement trial. The artwork consists of colourful dots painted on the road and pavement, which costs around $100,000. For more on this, although, you know, kind of the idea is to, I guess, to slow the traffic down. But for more on this, I'm joined by Blind Low Vision NZ Access and Awareness Advisor and sometime panellist, Chris Orr. Chris, welcome to the panel.
Yeah, kia ora, Wallace. How are you, mate?
I'm very well, Chris. Really interesting because, you know, often these sort of designs are lauded for the goal to slow down traffic, but we don't think of the unintended consequences. What sort of issues can this cause for people with low vision?
Yeah, particularly for people with low vision, it's not so much where the artwork is on the roadway, it's when it's on the footpath.
Oh.
So it's not just the roadway where you have the, it's not just dots, it's all sorts of wonderful, colourful designs that are there. And it's where they're placed is our concern, in that where people with low vision and blind usually walk is along the building line, what we call a clear, accessible path of travel. And it's when that coloured artwork is in that area where it brings concerns to us. So if it's not in that area, it's not so bad. But it's also what type of paint is used. Because if you've got a really bright, crisp, shiny colour, that causes glare problems. When you've got any bit of, that gets a bit wet, or even in the summer, when you get the rain, the sun just bounces off and gives you glare problems. So there's that as well. But the key for us is keeping that clear, accessible path of travel free of paintwork. Also, on areas leading up to pedestrian crossings, the good old zebras, but also around controlled intersections. That's where it can have problems, because when your vision starts to dwindle, to fade, your vision becomes monochromic. So you see what I mean? So that a colour, bright red or bright green or something like that, then looks like a hole in the ground or an obstacle or something like that. That's our concern, is that we totally support the concept. It's great.
Okay.
You know, having nice bright colours and things, or, sorry, having coloured artwork, but not bright. We prefer a matte finish so you don't get the glare issues, and not on the zebra crossings or in that clear accessible path of travel. That's our concern.
Interesting stuff. Alan, what do you reckon?
Yeah, we've got these things on the road up by AUT, where I work.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, these big round things and stuff, they were put there, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years ago. Not quite sure why. So they're all sort of starting to crack now, and they're getting dirty and everything. It's not really, it doesn't look great, and I can't see the reason for it.
I wonder if it does succeed in slowing the traffic. Ali, what do you think? Do you see them in Christchurch?
Well, what we get here is a lot of stuff on the roads because of the cycleways that have gone in, and what they use is basically ground up glass, which is an interesting thing to use on a road where there are bikes and animals and things, but anyway, and so you get a bit of a sparkle but you don't get that glare off it. What I was going to ask though is, why is this work not done in consultation with those who it's going to affect? Is there consultation done?
Not on this particular project. We found out that they're all around the Motu. There are lots and lots of different places, and they're an initiative in partnership with the local territorial authority. So in Christchurch, Ali, it would be the Christchurch City Council, and Waka Kotahi or even Environment Canterbury would be involved. But we have not been involved in this particular project with any consultation at all. We only found out about it when there was some concern raised by the local community.
So you do not? Do you know why? I mean, it sounds unusual. Mm.
No, I don't know why. As I say, we only found out about that. It's called Innovating Streets, this whole project right around the Motu. Mm. And we have been involved in some before the design was actually painted on the roadway, and that's worked well because we've been able to keep that clear accessible path of travel from the building by an out 1.8 metres. The intersections and the zebra crossings all kept clear, so that our clients can walk safely the same way as anybody else. And also that matte finish I was talking about, where you don't get that bright paintwork. If you guys get, if you're all drivers, I assume you are, you think of it on a day that's been raining and all of a sudden the sun comes out, you get that glare off the road. That's what it's like for our clients on a footpath.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming on the program and explaining the issue with us, Chris. Appreciate it, and hope to see you on the panel again sometime soon.
I'm looking forward to seeing you again as well.
That is Blind Low Vision NZ Access and Awareness Advisor Chris Saw, but clearly that can't stand Canada, Ali. If something looks like a hole in the ground, that's got to be repaired. And I think, as you said, that consultation aspect is imperative.
It doesn't make sense to me. You know, I started off by talking about let's not judge who's the numpty that did this.
You see, judging is human nature.
Oh, I can't help it. I tried.
Judge not, lest ye be judged.
I know.
You see, you've got to judge. It's important. Now, on that, Catherine says, so great to hear blind, low vision discussing this. I've been raising these issues with AT since they first appeared in Federal Street, Auckland, CBD. AT say they run things past a disability group, but this is nonsense and a waste of money in Catherine's point of view. And a bit of response regarding what some see as ageism. My husband is 55, was made redundant during COVID last year. He's also visually impaired. We can't get an interview even, or a benefit, because I work 26 hours a week. Another one here. My husband retrained with an IT degree as a 50-year-old ex-electrician. We moved to Wellington in 2004 to take up a full-time position with a utilities company. He's now 68, still employed by the same company as a senior developer and a respected team member. And on that wonderful note, kia ora to you both. You've been fantastic. Ellie Jones, have a great afternoon and evening.
Thank you, and you too.
Yeah, and you too, Professor Alan Blackman. Nice to have you on.
Thank you very much.
I'm Wallace Chapman. See you tomorrow, Wednesday's show, 3:45. Till then, bye.